rising, rising.
One of the things at stake in this election is not actually on the ballot. It's what our politics and political institutions look like in the future. For the Republican Party, the midterms are turning into a referendum on Trumpism. For the Democratic Party, the past year and a half have been a period of intense debate about the party's values, about which voters it tries to appeal to and mobilize, where it will and will not take money from, and how its internal governance systems work. The most thorough public intervention on this front was a report put together by a collection of people from the progressive wing of the party. Freshly energized by the insurgent Bernie Sanders campaign in the 2016 primary, it was called Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis. And now, after a year of public battles on primary ballots and policy fights inside the Democratic National Committee, they're out with a one-year update. I'm joined by the editor of that report, Norman Solomon. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Brian.
What was your goal with this project in the first place?
From the outset, really, to fill a gap that was left by the failure, really, of the Democratic National Committee to do what traditionally a national party does after a catastrophic election, and that is to put together what is shorthanded as an autopsy. It was really conspicuous because you get into 2017. It was such a horrific result to put Trump in the White House, etc. And yet the Democratic National Committee basically engaged in no autopsy or really public self-examination, self-assessment at all. So at rootsaction.org, we basically commissioned an independent task force to look at what went wrong for 2016. And inevitably, that meant going back to backstories for many years. And we issued that report exactly a year ago. And to put it mildly, it was very critical, very tough. It got a pretty resonant response, including the great chronicler of the Democratic Party, William Grider, wrote a front page, really a cover story for The Nation, examining our autopsy in detail. And we got a lot of positive response from the grassroots, as well as back channel some real unhappiness from the new regime of the Democratic National Committee under Chair Tom Perez. So this summer, we realized that it would be appropriate to issue a one-year later update, which is what we've just done. And by the way, it's on the web at democraticautopsy.org. And I'm glad to say that there have been some significant changes in the last 12 months.
What do you think are the most significant?
I would put in the positive category party democracy. A lot of the outrage during the 2016 campaign from Bernie Sanders delegates, and I think some disquiet even among Hillary Clinton supporters, was the use of superdelegates to really tilt the scales for the favorite Hillary Clinton. And a good analogy, I think, is if you have a race between two contestants and the starting gun goes off and one contestant is way ahead, that is in the form of establishment superdelegate support. And it's not just, okay, they have, in the case of Hillary Clinton, before a single ballot was cast in a primary caucus, half of all the superdelegates already in her corner, Bernie getting almost none, but also what that brings in terms of the label of front runner and momentum and fundraising and so forth. So that, I think, was a major blight on the party and any sense among not just progressives, but a lot of other folks, a blight on the notion that the Democratic Party functioned well, to use the word, democratically. So the Unity Reform Commission of the Democratic National Committee was put in place, really, I think, to try to smooth over those problems and create a sense of unity. And long story short, we're able to say in this autopsy that there has been real progress because the power of superdelegates, which is members of Congress who are Democrats, other elected officials, some lobbyists, their power essentially to help determine who the nominee for president of the party, that power has been virtually eliminated. There has not been a second ballot in choosing a Democratic Party presidential nominee. since 1952. And by eliminating their power to vote on the first ballot, I think it's a message and also a way of saying from the top of the party, we hear you. We're understanding that the cohesion of pro-Hillary forces in November 2016 was really damaged by this undermining of democracy within our own party. That's a plus. Also, voter participation. We chronicled a year ago that there was scant staffing at the DNC to fight this awful, racist, xenophobic voter suppression that Republicans have implemented and executed in so many states. And in the last year, the DNC has upped the staffing. It has given money in more than 40 states to, as much as possible, combat voter suppression. So I think those are some of the most important positive trends in the last year.
And where has it been lagging the most?
I think in two categories that we also chronicle in this report. One is corporate power. What Bernie Sanders was talking about throughout the campaign, what he called the oligarchy. And, you know, since then, the news media, as before, you would think that the only oligarchs were in Russia. Well, they also exist in the United States with a huge leverage over the political and media electoral system. And in the last year, there's really been no positive movement. As a matter of fact, we talk about in this new report that many Democrats in the House and Senate voted in favor of rolling back key provisions of Dodd-Frank in terms of banking regulation. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and the DNC still take large quantities of corporate funds. And it's been notable that the leadership of the Democrats in both houses of Congress, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, have really not been willing to address the power of Wall Street and the big banking industry and so forth over party funding and really policy. So that's been, if anything, worse. I think the Dodd-Frank vote is an indication. The other big area has to do with militarism, war in the Democratic Party. There was a set of news releases put out by Chuck Schumer and by Nancy Pelosi at the time of the recent vote over the Trump budget to increase military spending, which they like to call defense spending, by 11%. And it's just astronomical increases in what's already a bloated and destructive military budget. And both Pelosi and Schumer boasted and bragged in their news releases, we stand firmly behind President Trump's budget increases for the Pentagon. And it's very difficult to find people in the top layers of Democratic Party leadership on Capitol Hill who challenge the very concept of perpetual war. They're all in. We do have some positive signs. Ro Khanna from South Bay in the House has done great work to challenge, for instance, the U.S. support for Saudi Arabia and the war on Yemen. There are some bright spots, but when it comes to leadership, the Democratic Party is still very much on the war train.
It seems like one of the trends in this election has been record amounts of grassroots donations coming directly into Democratic coffers. And that diminishes the comparative power of someone like Nancy Pelosi, who one of her functions within the party is to connect the donor class to the elected officials.
Yes, I think that this is a gradual sea change, if you will, that hopefully we're just beginning to see. When Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won in the primary, this huge upset in Queens and Bronx, Pelosi was quick to say it was an anomaly and didn't speak to underlying dynamics for the Democratic Party in the country. And yet, I think Bernie Sanders showed the tremendous resonance when leaders and potential leaders running for office speak to questions of class, of economic inequality, and the power of Wall Street. And the traditional paradigm is exactly what you described. Progressives who are griping about it don't matter. But Bernie raised, of course, huge amounts of money on an average of $27 per donation and shown that you can blow away the big corporate interests in funding terms by appealing to the base. And I think there's a lot of ambivalence. And we have a section in this autopsy update about social movements in the party. The DNC and the Democratic Party leadership, they need social movements. They need progressives who are spoken for by those social movements to contribute money to the party and to volunteer and to vote. But generally, they haven't wanted us to do anything else like push them towards, say, Medicare for All. And I think there's been a recognition that the power of the base has been mobilized to such an extent that, for instance, almost all of the major Democratic presidential contenders who are being touted for 2020 have now called for single-payer Medicare for all, whereas 8 years ago, none of them had done that.
And Barack Obama said it was a good idea in September.
Safely out of office, he says it's a good idea. Something is changing here, and it's because of the power of people organizing and raising hell, whether it is democratizing the party, where there's been real progress, although not enough in the last year, and also a lot of policy issues such as health care. I imagine the people who are listening, there are a few who are thinking, the hell with the Democrats. Why bother with all this? Then other folks listening may think, well, we shouldn't be talking about what's wrong with the Democratic Party. We should just be focusing on Republicans. And I think both of those perspectives, while understandable, are, if I may say so, dead wrong. Because there is no way, unless we're going to get into a fantasy world, which isn't helpful in politics, there's no way to roll back the right-wing Republican power of the executive or legislative branch and increasingly in the judicial branch unless you get them out of office. And the only way you're going to do that from here to the horizon is get Democrats in to defeat them. So that, from the jump, should be clear that progressives have a huge stake in defeating Republicans. And then the other point of view is, oh, pipe down. Don't criticize Democrats. We're supposed to defeat Republicans. The problem with that is that unless you have stronger Democratic Party campaigns and stronger candidates able to defeat the Republicans, then it's counterproductive to say don't do self-critiques and improve yourself. On the one hand, there's a mythology, and the mass media reinforces constantly, that there's this left-to-right spectrum. It's all locked in. And when the right wing is entrenched, you have to move towards them to get the so-called persuadable, ostensibly moderate Republicans, an endangered species, to put it mildly. And so the much better strategy is one that's not worked out theoretically. It's worked out in the real world when you have someone such as Bernie Sanders leading the way to say there is such a thing as progressive populism. The Democratic Party is going to be a loser as long as it seems to defend an unjust status quo, not inspiring and mobilizing its base to organize and be active and turn out to vote.
I wonder if there isn't a parallel in coming up with a one-size-fits-all prescription. Like the country is not a uniform country. There are different dynamics in different districts. Maybe you need some people like Andrew Gillum running base mobilization campaigns, trying to get people to the polls who've never voted before. But if you want to defeat a Roy Moore in Alabama, the best strategy is to be an inoffensive centrist Democrat and let the guy facing multiple pedophilia accusations run against himself.
Well, there's no doubt that there are regional and local differences, and that's going to affect the terrain. At the same time, the conventional wisdom is, hey, you know, Bernie Sanders should have modulated if he wanted to appeal to those who, as it turned out, in many cases, were Trump voters. And that's where the left-right paradigm, the moderate left-right thing, tends to break down. I think of what happened in 1968 when Robert Kennedy, charismatic but also articulating a populist program, appealed to a lot of voters, including in the South, who then went for George Wallace. And one would think, why would people go from a anti-war left-wing candidate to a racist pro-war guy like George Wallace? And I think that unlike you and me and many people who feed on a lot of analysis and political views, most Americans are not ideological. They're practical. They think about what affects them. And as Jim Hightower, the great Texas populist, has been saying for decades, who won statewide in Texas, not a particularly left-wing state, to put it mildly, he says it's not so much left-right as up-down, and I think, you know, there are a lot of caveats there. There is such thing as a progressive left that we should embrace and fight for, but I think that there is something huge in potential for people speaking out and saying, I represent fighting the power structure. Doesn't need to be parsed in left-right terms. The upside of opportunistic politicians is that if you change what is opportunistic through the force of social movements, then you've got them. And if you can sustain those movements and transform public opinion in the country and mobilize it, then you have a real possibility to get allies functionally, if not emotionally and psychologically, at the top. And I think that is part of the refutation of those who say, well, you know, I'm not going to support any Democrats because the party's so bad, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The fact is, if we have Republicans in power, especially of the current type of Republican, but generally this has been true, no matter how powerful your social movements are, you're going to get a Gorsuch. You're going to get a Kavanaugh nominated by these right-wing racists in the Oval Office and who are around the Republican president. You can push on that wall all you want, but your capacity to change policy, whether it's for social justice in many dimensions, you're still up against state power, which is held by an immovable wall called the right wing. Whereas you get in an Obama, you get in someone who is more malleable, even worse depiction of him, an opportunist, still there's a base there that if it can be mobilized effectively can change the direction of the country. And I think that's where we are. So to be specific, a year and a half ago, Kamala Harris, the junior senator from California, was traveling around the country, meeting with the big donors, Bill Clinton, 1990 style, lining up for president as basically a new version of a new Democrat. And the organizing and the momentum and the hell raising around this country behind, for instance, single payer has had an aggregate effect. And as progressives has shown their muscle and ability to inject themselves into the electoral arena, she has signed on to single payer and she's sworn off corporate PAC money. And frankly, does that mean I trust her? No, it's not a matter of trust. It's a matter of creating the kind of pressure and political environment to hold feet to the fire and have some leverage over people in office.
So I guess that's the question I want to land on. What does it look like to organize not just for winning elections, but for accountability after Election Day?
I think every 2 years it should be 24 months every day. And part of the problem is putting people in office and then, oh, we did our job. You know, we elected Barack Obama. He's sworn in January 2009. It was a huge mistake. Groups backing off, trusting him. Don't trust people just because you like them and they're elected. Social movements are the only hope we have to get people elected who are more receptive to our program and then to keep them in a space that is not going to cave into Wall Street and the military-industrial complex power. On the contrary, we need to move them more and more in our direction. And I think it goes to the point that when grassroots people lead, leaders can be made to follow. When you think of all the great things that have happened in recent years in terms of public policy, for instance, marriage equality, that never came from people in leadership. As a matter of fact, I think you could argue whether it's $15 an hour or free college tuition as a program, none of that came from top elected officials in Washington. It's always been grassroots organizing and activists and thinkers. And it's heard, frankly, on and through the microphones of a station such as KPFA years before it's going to be heard on NPR News on a regular basis.
And why should we vote at their elections when there is no place for we, you and me, in the secret society they call us minorities? Why should we trust in politicians? And why should we vote at their elections when there is no place for we, you and me, in the secret society they call us minorities? Them have them new plan I implement, and it's their new world order government. We're in such a predicament. They're gonna treat us all like shit again, yeah. You know, to this there is no mystery. Still only those who have asked to see, they will see. It's only injustice and hypocrisy they're setting up for you and me. So why should we trust in politicians? And why should we vote at their elections when there is no place for we? All Rastafari set us free, yeah. We gather in one accord, chant seven songs a day, and chase their evil adversaries away, yeah. We gather in one accord, chant seven songs a day. The Lion of Judah, we gon' change, yeah. So why should we trust in politicians? And why should their elections, when there is no place for we, you and me,
They want one country to run the world, making it hard for the boys and girls. Oh, long them think them are gonna last. They're gonna fall like the evil rulers of the past. Oh, Lord Nebuchadnezzar, Julius Caesar, Napoleon, Mussolini, and Hitler. Oh,
Trump has announced plans to pull the United States out of a landmark nuclear arms pact with Russia in a move that could spark a new arms race. Ronald Reagan and former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev signed the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF, in 1987. The INF banned all nuclear and non-nuclear missiles with short and medium ranges. The treaty helped to eliminate thousands of land-based missiles. On Saturday, Trump vowed to build new nuclear weapons. Trump did not offer details on how Russia was violating the INF treaty. Over the years, Russia has also accused the United States of violating the agreement by deploying a missile defense shield in Romania. National Security Advisor John Bolton, who's advocated against the treaty, is now in Moscow for talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and President Vladimir Putin. Bolton has also opposed the extension of the 2010 New START agreement with Russia, which limited the number of deployed nuclear warheads on either side to 1,550.
Trump's plan to pull out of the nuclear arms deal has been criticized around the globe. Former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, who co-signed the deal in 1987, said, quote, "Do they really not understand in Washington what this could lead to? Quitting the INF is a mistake," Gorbachev said. China and France spoke out against the move, with the Chinese foreign ministry saying the document has an important role in developing international relations and nuclear disarmament and in maintaining global strategic balance and stability, unquote. To talk more about the implications of the U.S. withdrawal, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Daryl Kimball, director of the Arms Control Association. He previously led the coalition to reduce nuclear dangers, has been advocating for the U.S. and Russia to preserve the INF treaty. Welcome to Democracy Now. Were you shocked by Trump's announcement on Saturday? And explain exactly what it means, Daryl Kimball.
Well, I was not shocked because this appears to be a John Bolton-inspired decision by Trump to pull out of this very important agreement, which has eliminated, as you said, an entire class of intermediate-range missiles that once threatened Europe. 2,692 U.S. and Soviet missiles were verifiably eliminated as a result of this treaty. Russia has been testing a ground-launched cruise missile that the U.S. says was tested in excess of the range limit established by the treaty. They have not exhausted all the diplomatic opportunities that are available to resolve this issue. We've been working on that. And what Trump has done is, I think he has very prematurely, at best, to put a kind interpretation on it, the United States out of the treaty, shifting blame from Russia to President Trump for blowing up this very important agreement that's important for U.S. and European and Russian security. And it does absolutely nothing to bring Russia back into compliance with the treaty. And it opens the door for Russia to deploy in greater numbers this missile of concern, which is known as the 9M729. If Russia wants to, if this treaty is gone, all the constraints on the testing, the production, and the deployment of these missiles in Europe and elsewhere will be gone. And then Trump says, if Russia and China don't abide by this treaty, we're going to have to build missiles of this type. That kind of logic simply doesn't make any sense, given a few basic facts. One is China wasn't party to the INF treaty. The U.S. and Russia have been. The United States doesn't need ground-launched intermediate-range missiles to deal with China. In fact, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff last year said explicitly, we do not need such missiles to counter China. And the United States doesn't have any such missile in development, and there's no NATO country that would accept any such ground-launched cruise missile to be deployed in their territory. The last time that happened, back in 1983, there were millions of Europeans in the streets telling Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev to get rid of those missiles. So for a number of reasons, this is counterproductive, it's dangerous, and it does open the door to the possibility of renewed nuclear competition in this area. And it could threaten another important treaty, the new Strategic Arms Treaty, the main treaty limiting the two sides' strategic arsenals, which is due to expire in 2021 if Trump and Putin don't extend it.
Let's go back to the 1987 summit when President Reagan and Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev signed the Intermediate Range Nuclear Weapons Treaty, INF. Reagan talked about the significance of the deal.
The numbers alone demonstrate the value of this agreement. On the Soviet side, over 1,500 deployed warheads will be removed, and all ground-launched intermediate-range missiles, including the SS-20s, will be destroyed. On our side, our entire complement of Pershing II and ground-launched cruise missiles, with some 400 deployed warheads, will all be destroyed. Additional backup missiles on both sides will also be destroyed.
So that's President Reagan speaking in 1987 about the importance of this agreement. Now, you spoke, Daryl, about the fact that Russia was violating this treaty, but Russia has also accused the U.S. of violating the treaty. Is there any truth to that?
Well, Russia has said they have deep concerns about whether the United States could convert defensive missile interceptors that are part of the U.S. missile defense architecture that are now in Romania and will be in Poland for offensive purposes. So they have said that that is a problem they have. So look, if we look at the situation, the United States has serious concerns about Russia's compliance. The Russians have concerns about U.S. future compliance. What really ought to happen is there should be an arrangement by which there are transparency visits by technical experts to examine these missiles of concern, and the two sides could conceivably work out an arrangement by which each side's concerns are addressed. And if Russia does have missiles that can fly in excess of the treaty limits, they could be called upon to stop deployment. But the two sides haven't gotten this far. There have not been discussions at the detailed expert level about how to resolve this. In fact, there have only been two meetings on the INF issue between U.S. and Russian officials since Trump came into office.
Can you talk about how many weapons does the United States have? How many does Russia have? Is this just a gift to the weapons manufacturers? Just no holes barred, take all restraints off?
You're right, Amy. We got to put all this in perspective. You know, even though the Cold War is over, so to speak, the weapons that were created during the Cold War still exist. And the nuclear strategies that the United States and Russia had at that time are still very much in place. So as we sit here this morning chatting about this, the United States deploys about 1,400 warheads on long-range bombers and missiles on land and on sea. The Russians have equivalent numbers. About 800 of those could be launched on an order from the president within about 20 minutes. So that means that both sides remain on hair trigger. If there is a warning of an attack, the nuclear strategies call for the immediate launch of 800 or more nuclear warheads in retaliation. So that creates the chance for miscalculation. So we have massive overkill. We have a situation in which the fate of literally hundreds of millions of people rest in the hands of a small number of people, specifically Trump and Putin. So we're talking about making this situation worse by removing one of the treaties that was negotiated in the 80s by none other than Ronald Reagan that helped end the Cold War. So this does reopen the possibility of a new arms race, which, of course, would certainly benefit the weapons contractors that would build any new weapons.
What is at stake with the New START treaty? And does this give an indication that Trump will pull out of this? I mean, Bolton has been opposed to that as well.
Yeah, Bolton, before he came into office, he wanted to pull out of the INF treaty. He has said negative things about the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. So that treaty was negotiated by Barack Obama in 2010. It's scheduled to expire in February 5, 2021, just a few days after the next inauguration day. Trump and Putin could, however, agree to extend it by 5 years, along with the transparency and verification provisions that are very important. And right now, John Bolton is leading an interagency review about whether to extend the treaty, trash the treaty, or try to renegotiate some new treaty in the little amount of time left between now and 2021. So if we look at this INF decision, I'm very worried that John Bolton is headed in the same direction with respect to the New START treaty. And if that's the case, we would not have legally binding limits on the world's two largest arsenals for the first time since 1972. So it's very important for Congress to step up, Republicans and Democrats who support the New START treaty, to press Trump to extend this treaty, to buy us some more time so that we can at least have these limits in place and pursue further negotiations with Russia to further reduce the bloated and costly arsenals.
Isn't this also a message to China that President Trump is sending?
Well, he may think so. I don't think the Chinese are particularly perturbed. You know, China has most of its arsenal on ground-launched missiles with a medium or intermediate range. It just has to do with geography. They're under no pressure to join the INF treaty, and they have a relatively small, about 300 nuclear weapons arsenals that they feel is sufficient to deter the United States. So he may think he's sending a message to China, but I don't think it's a very effective one.
And what does it mean? Is the U.S. out since Trump said they are?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, these discussions between John Bolton and the Russians today in Moscow, I think, will be key. It is not clear whether Trump is actually pulling out. It may be that they're trying to threaten that the U.S. will pull out if Russia doesn't do something in particular. That's not clear. My Russian contacts have not yet heard anything like that. Our European allies have not heard anything like that. But I think it's quite likely, if we remain on the current track, that the INF treaty will be terminated by Trump sometime in 2019.
This is a mob world. This is the mob world. What kind of fool do you think I am? You think I know nothing of the modern world? All my life it's been the same. I've learned to live by hate and pain. It's my inspiration drive.
Trump, who has aggressively been using the issue of immigration as an election campaign tool, has a new convenient target for his ire, a caravan of about 2,000 largely Honduran migrants heading north from Central America to the U.S. border. Joining me to put the Honduran migrant caravan into perspective is Hannah Hafter, senior grassroots organizer with the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. Welcome to the program, Hannah.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Thanks for joining us. Well, this isn't the first time that a caravan of people has headed to the United States. I understand that the reason why these folks are traveling in a large group is to protect themselves because there's safety in numbers and that they're often preyed upon in their very dangerous journey from Central America to the United States. Is that correct?
Absolutely. The organizing of caravans is a really intentional political strategy on the part of people who are in the caravans. The journey north is dangerous under every circumstance, riding on the top of trains. Even when you arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border, many asylum seekers are finding themselves turned away by Border Patrol, even though they are entitled to request asylum. And so by organizing a larger caravan, both the safety in numbers and the attention that they receive, doing more to ensure that international law is actually applied and that they can pursue asylum through the due process that they deserve.
So this particular caravan has been making its way from Honduras up to the U.S. border. Just a few days ago, they reached Guatemala. There was one tense point where the Guatemalan authorities essentially stopped the caravan, but then they did let them pass through. As far as you know, what happened in Guatemala?
Well, what we're seeing is the Trump administration's call for action resulting in increased militarization on the southern borders of Mexico and Guatemala in a way that really has no benefit to those countries or their people. It's really an exporting of the dirty work of the United States to the southern borders. And so watching that video, I was incredibly moved by the people who stood their ground and understood that they had a right to pursue a better future and freedom from violence. And ultimately, I believe that both in terms of the overpowering numbers and in terms of the moral authority of those seeking freedom from violence, they were able to make it through into Guatemala. And we know that there is riot gear being prepared at the southern Mexico border. We know Trump has made threats of sending the military to the U.S.-Mexico border, although the feasibility of that is very questionable and the legality as well. But ultimately, people are asserting that if the conditions at home are not livable, they will find a way to be somewhere that they can have a future.
Presumably, Hannah, these folks know what awaits them in the United States. The family separation scandal here in the United States over the past summer made international headlines. Are these folks willing to risk being separated from their children? I mean, even though technically now that has stopped, at least the government is saying it's stopped, they are detaining minors. And Trump even very clearly said on his Twitter that you will be arrested at the border and detained before being deported. So the likelihood of them going through that is pretty high. They're still coming.
Yes, absolutely. So I have worked with dozens of families just south of the Mexico border that were in the process of preparing to cross. I've met many families that were separated and then released after being reunited. And I've worked with families in detention. And one thing I can say emphatically is that people who are taking this risk know what they're getting into. It's not true that they expect it to be easy. They know about the international outcry on family separation. And ultimately, they're forced to make a very difficult choice among very terrible options. And if the option is that you've been threatened for your life in the place that you live, and there are no economic opportunities, or you can take a risk to potentially get somewhere where you and your children have a future, people are going to take that risk. And we talk about this as if it's a border crisis. We talk about this as if the crisis begins as people are entering the United States. The truth is, this is only a symptom of a crisis. The caravan is a response to a crisis. It's not a crisis in itself. And the crisis is in the conditions in Honduras and in other countries of the Northern Triangle, where the degree of violence, the degree of impunity, one thing that we haven't talked about is the corrupt and fraudulent re-election of President Juan Orlando Hernandez and the instability that that caused. So people are leaving not because they're making a choice to potentially pursue something better for them, but because they see there really being no other option for their lives.
The response from the Trumpsters is solve problems in your own country instead of coming to ours, because they see people waving their Honduras flags and they're like, why aren't you solving your problems in your own country? Doesn't that show an ignorance of the U.S. role in making the situations in these countries pretty appalling? Doesn't the U.S. have a long history of training military leaders in countries like Honduras that then have essentially repressed Hondurans?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting how the Trump administration has suggested that in response to this, they will withdraw aid, when in fact, the vast majority of aid from the United States to Honduras is military aid. And activists in the country have actually been calling for years for a suspension of military aid when the Honduran government is using it against its own people with nonviolent uprisings related to corruption in the government. And so there's absolutely a long history. And often we think about the history in terms of things that happened in the mid-1900s, but that history is continuing today with the military coup that overthrew President Zelaya in 2009, which the United States was never willing to recognize as a coup, up to the 2017 Honduran elections, where President Juan Orlando Hernandez basically stacked the Supreme Court and then was allowed to be reelected against the country's constitution. And the United States government has recognized that illegitimate government since day one, which has, of course, provided a layer of legitimacy that has enabled it to continue. And so between that and the funding for the drug war, the incredible amount of military resources and funding that's going into Central America in the premise of fighting violent crime and drugs, but actually really spilling over into the civilian population and creating more and more of an unlivable, unstable environment, we certainly have a lot of responsibility to take there.
What about the temporary protected status program here in the United States? We have, of course, a lot of immigrants of Honduran background and other Central American nations like El Salvador and others. Haiti, of course, is another country whose people have had in the United States temporary protected status, a very specific program. And Trump has been systematically canceling those programs, hasn't he?
So what we're seeing from the Trump administration is an attack on immigrants of color from every side. And I emphasize the racism and xenophobia of immigrants of color because he is married to an immigrant who worked in the United States without a work permit. And yet, because she's white, she is not considered part of the threat, right? And so we see an attack both on undocumented and legal immigration in the United States. And temporary protected status is one of those categories of legal immigrants, along with the DACA recipients, that is being chipped away at. People with temporary protected status from Honduras have been in the country for a minimum of 10, 15 years. There needs to be a solution to temporary protected status that isn't just temporary. So yes, the Trump administration has basically canceled temporary protected status for a huge range of countries, from Haiti to Honduras to Nicaragua. And there is a court ruling that has temporarily held off the deportation of those people, but it's not a permanent solution. So we're calling on Congress, and there is legislation that has been introduced that we need more co-sponsors for, and we need to build the political will around to create a pathway to citizenship for people who've been in the country with temporary protected status. Because TPS holders actually have gone through criminal background checks and all kinds of screening every 2 years when they renew their status. So this is really a category of people who have really grounded lives in the United States. And to think that they would be deported back into the kinds of conditions that people are fleeing in Honduras is just unconscionable.
We do have a problem in a world where there are people fleeing violence, fleeing poverty, fleeing repression, right? I mean, one solution is for countries like the United States to welcome some of these refugees, which is essentially what they are, and to offer them a safe space, because often these refugees are going to be very productive members of society. But then also understanding what the problems are in their home countries and working together to solve them could be a priority as well. And unfortunately, that's never been the approach that our politicians here in the U.S. have taken. Hondurans, Salvadorans, Guatemalans, Mexicans, I'm sure, would prefer to remain in their homelands. How do you think we need to rethink this crisis?
Well, I so appreciate that comment, because I particularly think that immigration is an area where the left, and particularly the Democratic Party, has really failed to hold our ground by proposing immigration reform legislation under Obama that accepted the premise of border security and further enforcement in exchange for access to pathway to citizenship for some people, really drawing a line of who's the good immigrant, who's the bad immigrant, in a way that lacked humanity. Ultimately, a solution that is grounded in our common humanity does address the root causes. And we've put very little thought into that in terms of the amount of investment and energy that is directed towards supporting the solutions that people in Honduras are developing. There are all kinds of grassroots organizations in Honduras and people who are working to make their country a better place and a place where everyone has the right to stay and feels that they can stay if that's the choice they want to make. On the other side of things, family separation has fundamentally just been one building block in a whole project to dismantle the entire asylum system, especially for Central Americans. You have other things like Sessions' AB decision, which basically removes the right to asylum for women who have been threatened by domestic violence or gang violence or victims of very severe domestic violence or gang violence, plus now an effort to keep all asylum seekers incarcerated for the duration of their hearings, which can be years on end. It can cost billions of dollars. Most asylum seekers now are able to get out on a bond and to fight their case from outside of detention. And then additionally, this effort to undermine the Flores settlement, which would mean literally having children growing up in prisons with their parents and then creating what they're calling binary choice, which would mean parents who are seeking asylum being forced to choose between keeping their kids with them in prison indefinitely or allowing their children to be separated from them and placed with family members or in foster homes.
This is the new policy to replace the family separation policy that the Trump administration is touting and putting forward. And Hannah, it's really sad because given what happened this summer, when the entire nation was outraged, including a lot of conservatives, outraged at what they saw, the suffering of children and parents that they saw, this should have been a huge election issue that the Democrats could have bludgeoned the Republicans with. Instead, the Democrats are playing defense. They're trying not to talk about it. And it's the Republicans who are continually saying, oh, look, this, you know, the Democrats are responsible for, they want open borders. Trump is literally showing a video of the migrant caravan on his Twitter page saying, see what Democrats have made possible. The Republicans are still effectively, unfortunately, using immigration as an issue to garner votes, and the Democrats are staying largely silent. It's pretty sad.
It's both disturbing and illogical, to be frank, because the Republicans and the Trump administration were really on the defense with family separation. We really need to keep the issues facing Central American asylum seekers, not just from a human rights perspective, but from a global perspective and from the perspective of all the contributions that people make who come to this country. It doesn't make sense that they're the ones who get to control the narrative on immigration when they've already been exposed for the kinds of horrific human rights violations that they're committing. I think that it's up to us as, you know, the people that were responding to family separation to say, hey, actually, indefinite family detention is family separation 2.0. What we want is not for families to be reunited, held in prisons for months, and then deported to their deaths because there's no way for them to get asylum based on gang violence. Can you imagine coming to this country, fleeing for your life, knowing that there's a legal mechanism for your protection and being told actually the way that your life is being threatened, the particular person and context in which you would be killed doesn't receive protection just because it's gang violence, just because it's domestic violence, that no longer applies. It's so illogical.
Finally, in the last minute of our interview, what do you think will happen with this particular migrant caravan? The migrants are determined to make it to the United States. Presumably, they'll be filing asylum claims there. Trump is determined to stop them. It seems like a pretty dangerous flashpoint in the making.
I cannot say what will happen, and I agree it's a dangerous flashpoint, but it's dangerous to do this journey without a caravan. It's dangerous to be an individual or a small family trying to make this journey on your own. And so for those that do make it to the border, what I want to emphasize at the end of this interview is that there are many, many ways to support people who have made it to the United States, who are currently in immigration detention, pursuing their asylum claims. There are opportunities to offer host homes, to fundraise for bond funds to help people get out, to lobby in opposition to this new proposed rule to keep families in detention long term. There's an open comment period and some lawsuits in the works. So this is something that we can really be doing something about, not just wondering what's going to happen and sitting back to watch.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Hannah Hafter. Is there a website you'd like to share with us?
Absolutely. Our latest online action, which is related to the comment period to stop the unlimited expansion of family detention, you can find that on our website at www.uusc.org.
Thank you. You are listening to Mimo Radio. Hello, listeners. Welcome to a program of Flash Time Music.
Accessory to murder of Aaron Swartz.
It was depression suicide. Didn't you see the movie?
The Internet's Own Boy.
That was a great documentary.
A masterpiece. I especially enjoyed the part about his depression suicide.
Case closed.
We're talking about Aaron Swartz with District Attorney Carmen Ortiz and her handler.
No names, please.
Was Aaron Swartz compliant? Look, I don't have all the answers. Oppositional defiant disorder is a terrible affliction.
Submissive obedient syndrome is worse.
I don't have all the answers.
Yes, you do. The answers are all right here.
Did you publish this?
The Joint Terrorism Task Force does not operate sniper teams inside the 50 states.
Well, you better take that post down.
It's called the Freedom to Connect, dude.
Yeah, take that post down now.
What are you going to do if I refuse?
We were at the funeral with his father. He made a very lucid point about the duplicity of our society that protects those who accumulate wealth and treats those like Aaron in a completely different fashion. This was, and I say it without hesitation, not suicide. It was murder. We understand that if we allow the climate of fear to exist, the damage that will be done is that the next Aaron will not come. This system that is in America today is an abuse of state power. A fitting legacy for Aaron would be the dismantling of this system.
The voice is Ron Singer, remembering Aaron Swartz. I'm Brooklyn Kid, and this is Twitlet Radio. Are we ready?
Let's go.
Ready.
Okay, ready.
I'm ready, dude. For 10 points and a chance to unschool your mind, give a half-true answer to this question. Who killed Aaron?
The bully of Boston, Carmen Ortiz.
Assistant DA Hyman.
The Pentagon, dude.
We have a tie. Why does this keep happening?
Aaron Swartz filed a Freedom of Information Act request on behalf of Bradley Manning.
We hear now a statement by the district attorney.
I vigorously deny the charges. My office did not do this. The Swartz prosecution was very important to me.
Many federal agencies had him under surveillance.
For what?
Suspicious activity.
I will take one or two questions.
Define suspicious activity.
The defendant had earlier filed Freedom of Information requests on behalf of Bradley Manning.
Is that a crime?
Assistant D.A. Hyman can answer that question better than me.
U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz is innocent of any wrongdoing in this case. Bradley Manning had spent time in Boston.
While the investigation into Bradley Manning was on hold, I was frustrated. Frankly, I was depressed. I was depressed. Nothing was moving. Then these FOIA requests from Mr. Swartz had the potential to shut down the investigation.
Go ahead.
MIT is a military contractor. Mr. Swartz was an out-of-control file sharer.
If he shared those files with Al-Qaeda, it would ruin everything.
Al-Qaeda can hack into classified research computers and learn how this technology is used.
Keep talking.
I also sit on the Joint Anti-Terrorism Task Force, so what I know is firsthand.
And the wheels of justice take it from there. One last question.
Is the DA charged with accessory to murder?
My client is innocent.
The Pentagon is not my responsibility.
Did you engage in illegal file sharing with the Pentagon?
As there are charges pending, I will defer that question to my lawyer.
Aaron Swartz had other enemies in the federal government.
If there was one day the shit crystallized, I think it was the day of the hearings on SOPA in the House. The day we got that phrase, it's no longer okay not to understand how the internet works. There was just something about watching those clueless members of Congress debate the bill, watching them insist they could regulate the internet and a bunch of nerds couldn't possibly stop them. They really brought it home for people that this was happening, that Congress was going to break the internet, and it just didn't care. I remember when this moment first hit me. I was at an event, and I was talking, and I got introduced to a U.S. senator. And I asked him why, despite being such a progressive, despite giving a speech in favor of civil liberties, why he was supporting a bill that would censor the internet. And, you know, that typical politician smile he had suddenly faded from his face, and his eyes started burning this fiery red. And he started shouting at me. So those people on the internet, they think they can get away with anything. They think they can just put anything up there, and there's nothing we can do to stop them. They put up everything. They put up our nuclear missiles, and they just laugh at us. Well, we're going to show them. There's got to be laws on the internet. It's got to be under control. Now, as far as I know, nobody has ever put up the U.S.'s nuclear missiles on the internet. But that's sort of the point. He wasn't having a rational concern. Right? It was this irrational fear that things were out of control. Here was this man, a United States senator, and those people on the internet, they were just mocking him. They had to be brought under control. Things had to be under control. And I think that was the attitude of Congress. And just at seeing that fire in that senator's eyes scared me, I think those hearings scared a lot of people. They saw this wasn't the attitude of a thoughtful government trying to resolve trade-offs in order to best represent its citizens. This was more like the attitude of a tyrant, so the citizens fought back. Wikipedia went black. Reddit went black. Craigslist went black. The phone lines on Capitol Hill flat-out melted. Members of Congress started rushing to issue statements retracting their support for the bill that they were promoting just a couple days ago. Former Senator Chris Dodd, now the chief lobbyist for Hollywood, he admitted after he lost that he had masterminded the whole evil plan. And he told the New York Times he'd never seen anything like it during his many years in Congress. And that was when, as hard as it was for me to believe, after all this, we had won. The thing that everyone said was impossible, that some of the biggest companies in the world had written off as kind of a pipe dream, we did it. We won. Everyone took it as their job to save this crucial freedom. They threw themselves into it. They did whatever they could think of to do. They didn't stop to ask anyone for permission. The senators were right. The internet really is out of control. But if we forget that, if we let Hollywood rewrite the story so it was just big company Google who stopped the bill, if we let them persuade us we didn't actually make a difference, and we start seeing it as someone else's responsibility to do this work, well, then next time, they might just win. Let's not let that happen.
The voice is Aaron Schwartz. I'm Berkeley Kidd, and this is TwitWit Radio.
Persistent ambient surveillance.
Persistent surveillance is helpful and friendly.
I'm talking with U.S. District Attorney Carmen Ortiz, the bully of Boston. Carmen, are you a psychopath?
Define psychopath.
That information is freely available to anyone who can afford it.
Look, I am the first to admit that I don't have all the answers.
Yes, you do. The answers are all right here.
Did you publish this?
It's called The Freedom to Connect, dude.
I know that there is little that I can say to abate the anger of those who believe that the prosecution of Mr. Schwartz was unwarranted. I did not want it to end like this. My conduct was appropriate.
There is no evidence that U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz overreached for personal or political gain. Her conduct and her campaign will continue.
I dropped the charges as soon as I heard about it. I was totally surprised. I was out of the loop.
I have a question for Carmen Ortiz.
Go ahead, dear.
Can stupidity be taught without standardized testing? Retweet. Listeners can post TwitWit on Twitter and somebody here will slip it into the conversation.
Sharing government passwords is a felony.
How did you do that?
It was a lucky guess.
That's against the law.
Throw the book at him, Carmen.
If punishment works so well, why do you have to keep doing it? Over and over and over. Take him down.
That kind of led me down this path of questioning things. You know, once I questioned the school I was in, I questioned the society that built the school, I questioned the businesses that the schools were training people for, and I questioned the government that set up this whole structure.
Ms. Ortiz and Mr. Hyman, Goldman Sachs and Rupert Murdoch, J.P. Morgan Chase and Mr. Eric Schmidt. We're not going away. We'll be back every day. We're coming after you. It's time to pack your bags, take your fake false flags and Brzezinski too. For the benefit of a tiny few who haven't got a clue, it's the end of your world. It's collapsing on top of you.
I have a suspicious activity report here with your IP address on it, little girl.
What did I do?
You said Aaron Schwartz was hot.
And I've seen that transcript.
Is that a crime?
Privacy is a suspicious activity.
Privacy with an open back door is not privacy.
What back door?
An open back door is a coded euphemism for the NSA has all our data.
Are you wearing a hidden microphone?
Absolutely not. Sometimes.
Next clue.
The Pentagon Film Office.
Can you prove it?
Define prove. Next clue, please. A genius who bucks the system. I would like to guess the identity of the mystery ghost. Are you the ghost of Gary Webb? No.
Are you the ghost of Steve Jobs?
No. Your final clue. Aaron Schwartz lives forever.
Are you the ghost of Aaron Schwartz?
We have a winner.
This is so exciting.
How old would Aaron Schwartz be today if he hadn't been murdered?
It was a depression suicide. Was Building 7 a depression suicide?
No. Building 7 suffered from sudden building collapse syndrome.
I sat on the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Nobody told me anything. As the district attorney for Boston, it was my job to prosecute Mr. Schwartz. He was facing 35 years in the prison library.
35 years for illegal file sharing.
If it wasn't depression suicide, what was it?
I will not dignify that remark.
District Attorney Carmen Ortiz was nowhere near the crime scene.
The body was found hanging from a rope in his apartment.
Was he murdered?
Murder is a euphemism for I will take no more questions.
Murder!
Murder in the first degree.
You see evidence of conspiracy wherever it appears.
You see evidence of depression wherever you need an alibi.
The National Security State did it, and you know it.
I didn't behead anybody.
The beheadings in Iraq and Syria are NATO operations, and you know it.
I know nothing about NATO operations.
Not at my watch.
Carmen Ortiz is a self-hating shrew.
Why are we still here?
Does the Joint Terrorism Task Force have its own sniper team?
The term sniper team is a euphemism.
It means your name is on a list.
Question time.
Step up to the microphone and produce a urine sample with your IP address.
You already have all that. My question is about the invisible anti-war movement. Where is it?
The leadership committee voted to study the question.
Well, the leadership committee is broken.
Oh, God. He keeps harassing me. Will you just go away?
I will never go away. I'm not a quitter.
You are dead to me, Schwartz. Do you hear me? You are dead to me.
Carmen,
no.
Behave yourself.
No. So what if Bradley Manning was set up to take the blame? I don't care who knows it.
Carmen, please. Hey, did they put truth serum in the tea again?
500 mics.
Who killed Aaron Schwartz?
The Pentagon Special Effects Department.
Why?
Do not answer that, Carmen.
Aaron Schwartz was on his way to becoming a living folk hero, for God's sake.
What are you afraid of?
Charismatic individuals who buck the systems and blame NATO.
Aaron Schwartz had crossover appeal. He could have ruined everything.
Young geniuses nurtured and carefully watched.
We offered him a place with the inner party elite. And he turned it down.
So he was exterminated?
It is always a painful duty.
So sad.
Who could ever live in a world like that?
Apparently not me.
Was there something wrong with you?
Yes. I was a boy genius. I could figure things out, solve problems.
What's wrong with solving problems?
Well, making problems is more profitable.
Do you have a solution?
No. I have a slogan. Keep the wars going. Vote Democratic or Republican.
Oh. He's getting depressed again.
What are you depressed about?
I'm not depressed. I'm concerned. I'm concerned about your professional ethics.
Professional ethics is a euphemism for the terms and conditions agreement.
Have the terms and conditions changed?
Changed to what?
To something else you're never going to read either.
What can we do about it?
The Justice for Aaron Schwartz Committee will not rest until every FOIA request has been examined, including the minutes of the Joint Terrorism Task Force on the night of the murder.
If Aaron Schwartz didn't hang himself, who did it?
The Caliphate.
The what?
The Caliphate. ISIS. The Islamic State. They're everywhere. Caliphate. I want is the Islamic State, some oil wells and real estate. I disbelieve in holy war. Suddenly, I miss the Imam I used to be. There's a drone circling over me, and Al-Qaeda has changed its name. State is here to stay, pretending not to be NATO.
Round 43. The category is privacy versus freedom. for 60 points. Give a misleading answer to this question. Who's watching the watchers? Who's watching?
Would you repeat the question?
Who's watching the watchers?
Drop the beans!
We have a winner. Dub Dude is on the scoreboard.
Yeah.
Hey.
All
right.
Yeah. I'm talking with the bully of Boston, Carmen Ortiz, U.S. District Attorney charged with murder of Aaron Swartz. Are you going to cop a plea?
It is a felony to share information over the internet without permission of the owners. My office protects intellectual property from criminals. Aaron Swartz was an unfortunate example.
I have a question for Ms. Ortiz.
I can't stay long.
Do you have any remorse?
Downloading scientific journals without paying the fee is a serious offense.
13 felony counts?
It sends a message.
Keep talking.
What message?
The internet is out of control.
That's why I like it, dude.
That kind of talk gives aid and comfort to Al-Qaeda.
What does Al-Qaeda want, Carmen?
Al-Qaeda wants America to pray on the floor.
It's Al-Qaeda and it's always Al-Qaeda. Always Al-Qaeda, always Al-Qaeda. It's Al-Qaeda when it happens to you.
Well, for a long time, what I would do is I had nothing on the web that said how old I was, and I wouldn't tell anyone, really. Until, you know, one day, there was a newspaper article about me winning the contest at MIT, and someone found it and, you know, replied back to the list, wow, he's 13, you know, according to this article. And that day, you know, it really sort of struck me that it wasn't really something I needed to hide from, that now that people really realized that I could communicate, I didn't have to hide that fact anymore. The Cypherpunks was one of the first lists I joined. I was interested in that sort of encryption and that sort of thing a while back, and I joined the Cypherpunks, and I was 13 or only 14 now. By then, you know, the excitement had sort of gone out a bit. All the interesting stuff had been done already. And then after that comes, you know, my own work, my project Blog Space, which allows people to build websites, and, you know, the other projects I'm working on right now, writing my articles about unschooling and about educational philosophy, which is to say that anyone can say whatever they want on any machine, and there's no real central control that has all the knowledge in it. It can pretend to, it can get a really close approximation, but I don't think it's ever possible to get all the way there. The voice is philosopher Aaron Swartz. I'm Berkeley Kaden. This is Twitwit Radio. We are talking with U.S. District Attorney Carmen Ortiz, known as the Bully of Boston, now charged with the murder of Aaron Swartz.
My client is pleading not guilty.
I wasn't anywhere near the crime scene.
Murder!
The case was delegated to my assistant. I didn't do it.
He uncovered classified documents.
Have you ever leaked a classified document to mislead the public?
An unauthorized leak? Never.
On whose orders?
No comment.
And you?
Leadership and likability profiles can detect criminal activity before it's too late.
A kill list?
I don't call it a kill list.
Ms. Ortiz was doing her job.
It wasn't my call. I wanted to drop the case.
Why is this always happening then, huh? Is it happening now?
No. Now I'm running for the Senate.
If predictive analysis can tell us who our enemies are going to be, shouldn't you be stopped right now?
You don't want to wait too long.
Are you on their side now?
He was on his way to being a national folk hero.
What did he do?
He murdered Sopa in the crib.
Well, why don't you prosecute the banks then?
Goldman Sachs is too big to prosecute. This tea has a bitter taste.
Oh, what is in this tea?
The determination that a person, particularly an American citizen, captured in the United States is an enemy combatant. They need not be guilty of anything. They are detained simply by virtue of their status as enemy combatants in war.
Aaron Swartz was remembered at 11 hackathons.
I think Aaron Swartz is hot.
He's dead. It was a depression suicide.
Case closed.
In your dreams.
Aaron Swartz was an enemy combatant. He was imprisoned, tortured, and hung out to dry.
The case is not closed.
That is so negative.
For 20 points, give a misleading answer to this question. The Joint Terrorism Task Force, where are they now?
They're on a speaking tour.
They're on a book tour.
I have the IP addresses of everyone on tour. Yeah.
Tor is a broken privacy solution. The software was deliberately flawed.
Point of too much information.
Fact check has a point.
No one can follow what you're talking about.
Well, talking in euphemisms is an affordable privacy solution.
Talking in euphemisms is a suspicious activity report just waiting to happen.
I didn't say District Attorney Carmen Ortiz is evil, but the logic of your situation makes you do evil things sometimes.
It is well known that Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs bent the rules for their own good. They did it for themselves. They engaged in shady practices of use of public property whilst at the university in their early days. None of them faced 35 years in prison. They are worthless, self-aggrandizing egomaniacs who use technology for the good of the 1%.
Collusion, the president can do whatever he wants. Alternative facts, alternative facts. Kelly, no collusion. Yes.
What are you doing?
I'm doing vocal warm-ups.
I'm never gonna die, folks. I'm never gonna die. That's right. Forever. I'm gonna live forever.
All right, I'm ready. Go ahead. Ask me anything. You know me. I'm an open book.
When's the last time you saw him?
I'm insulted by the premise of that question.
When was the last time you saw Trump?
I haven't seen him.
I saw Daddy on the tape, same as everyone else.
The deposition tape. We have other copies of that.
He vanished. Donald Trump has been missing since 2024. 6 years now.
He left. He's gone. He took the midnight bus to Georgetown, like the song.
When was the beginning of the end?
Well, I guess it was 2018 when the Democrats took the House and made Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez the Speaker.
And Chair of Ways and Means. And Oversight and Banking and Foreign Affairs and starting pitcher on the softball team.
The new Democratic-led Congress announcing their intentions to file articles of impeachment.
It was scary. Everyone was talking about impeachment because of what Cohn told them, and because of what Eric told them, and because of what I told them, and because of what Melania told them, and because of what Ivanka told them, and because of what Jared told them.
This was different than with Mueller because Cortez was, well...
She was hot.
She was like Cheetah Rivera with subpoena power.
I mean, the president got his wires crossed.
Speaker Ocasio-Cortez is a very treacherous, beautiful, un-American, lovely, dishonest, luscious.
Dad was thinking with his dick, and his dick didn't work anymore.
I told the president he should get out of Washington.
80 cities in 40 days, rallies, troop visits.
People called it
Trump stock.
Trump stock.
Trump stock. Trump stock.
An 80-city rally tour to, in the words of the president, make America more American, or MAMA.
We need to MAMA. I need my MAMA. I need my MAMA. I need MAMA. 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 Who wants a part? George Zimmerman. Bill Cosby. Ted Kaczynski.
Trump stock was when Donald Trump really hit his stride, but in a bad way. Nothing was sacred. Nothing.
Look at the lying media. They're right there, folks. The lying media right there. If I were you, I'd beat the shit out of them right now. Beat the shit out of them. I'm going to burn this country to the ground, and then I'm going to blow my f***ing brains out. Who said that? Who said that? Not me. Remember, what you're seeing isn't happening. I could win the Democratic primary. Maybe I could win the Democratic primary. Should I run in the Democratic primary? I could do it. Should I? I could do it. Should I run in the Democratic primary? What do you say? I'm going to run. I'm running, and I'm going to win in vote filing.
Running for the nomination of the opposition party was crazy.
In Iowa tonight, candidate Trump claimed he was the only Democrat who could win back the white working class voters won by President Trump in 2016.
I had hoped earlier he would withdraw as a candidate. That obviously is not going to happen.
How stupid does Trump think we Americans are?
Hello, hippies. I've got a coupon for Blue Apron. Offer code Trump.
Trump's not going to be the nominee.
I will bet anyone on the stage a nice dinner that Donald Trump is not going to be the nominee.
Hey, look at these guys. You got Crazy Bernie, Pocahontas, Crazy Joe, Crazy Corey, Crazy Camilla. So many crazies.
He was cutting through that primary like a knife through a corpse being dismembered in a hot tub.
I'm a big liberal. I drive an electric car. My best friend is a wheelchair-bound Asian with no eyes.
Donald Trump is playing by different rules.
I hear Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer f***ing.
And it's looking more and more like he could be the nominee.
Gays are the best, but so are the blacks, right? There's a black right there.
Oh, my God.
Tonight, I stand before you as the Democrat nominee for President of the United States.
We won. Again.
So much winning.
Of course, now your hot tub filter will get clogged if you try that.
It's Trump versus Trump, as the president looks ready to waltz into his second term.
The president had a full house. He bet it all on black, and the dice were coming up snake eyes. Yahtzee.
And then, the unthinkable.
We are ready to make this projection. In a stunning upset with 37% of the vote and 271 electoral votes, the winner of the 2020 presidential election is Green Party candidate Jill Stein. No one saw this coming.
Конечно, мы кокернули выборы в пользу Джилл Стайн. Для Америки Россия всегда добивается самого идиотского результата.
President, now he'll be delivering a concession speech. We're being told he wrote himself. Let's listen in.
Unbelievable. I never trusted those caviar shitting sons of bitches.
My fellow Americans, we won, everybody! We won! Don't listen to the lying enemy media and the stupid Green Party. I'm still president.
Yeah, he refused to concede. He unilaterally declared victory like a king or a crazy person or a king who's gone crazy.
It's been 3 weeks and President Trump has still not conceded.
Protests outside the White House entered their second month with no end in sight.
We're now on day 77 of the White House standoff.
It was an unprecedented constitutional crisis.
And then, for the last time in our history, cooler heads prevailed.
My fellow Americans, and by Americans, I mean only the people who voted for me. I'll never concede. Concession speeches are for losers, and I'm no loser, folks. I beat myself in the general election, which is practically impossible. I'm a winner! This is a total disgrace. I disavow this election. I'm staying right behind this desk no matter what. You can't replace me, and definitely not with a woman. Me too? What about me? I'm being evicted like a South African farmer. I won the popular vote. This is white genocide. White genocide. I'll call the Electoral College. They like me. Where's the nuclear football? Give me the nuclear football. What's the number? 867-530. Whoa, a truck! Wow! Look at this.
And that's how the Trump presidency came to an end. And then things got really weird.
President Jill Stein taking the oath of office.
No one likes losing, but my family looked on it as an opportunity to come home to New York City.
And how were you welcomed?
Beautifully.
Yo, f*** you, traitor!
Trump's first year out of office was very difficult.
Melania Trump files for divorce just hours after her husband leaves office and is immediately spotted canoodling with Super Bowl MVP Colin Kaepernick.
And how was business after he lost?
The iconic Trump Tower has been renamed Amazon Tower after being purchased for pennies on the dollar by Jeff Bezos.
That was a low point. Even lower than my other lowest point with the kids in cages or whatever.
Ha! Is that all you got? You take the man's buildings away? You are a fly on Donald Trump's windshield.
But the president came back in a big way.
To be the president, we gotta do this.
Ivanka, could you help me with the posters? These condos aren't gonna sell themselves.
Shut up, Daddy. I'm on the phone with the Bank of Cyprus.
You shut up.
God damn it!
What do you mean you will not give us a loan? We made you and we can still break you.
I don't care about the money anymore. I don't wanna hear about we don't have any more money!
Dad!
What?
I did exactly what you said, and I paid out every single one of our investors.
You moron, I said take out the money, not pay out.
Whoops!
Idiot. Ivanka, what about a foot massage?
She always gets to do it.
She always will. There you go. Oh, oh, oh.
Bannon and Trump hadn't spoken in years, but they reunited for his next show because their on-screen chemistry was undeniable.
We're here in the basement of the FBI building, hunting for witches. We're going to root them out and take care of business. Let's move.
Oh, God.
Now get your hands off me. Who's touching me?
Get your goddamn hands off me! He's a witch!
Say? Oh, Kinarifi!
He's under the witch's spell!
His last show was, his last show was...
elected president.
We've launched another communication satellite, which is what NASA used to do, but now Space Force does it.
Space Force all the way.
Steve, you said there were going to be aliens here.
Damn it, Don. The aliens are down on Earth, swarming over our pristine alabaster continent.
Lock phaser lasers on Earth and fire.
Whoa!
Sir, the Earth has been destroyed.
That means that we're the last humans alive. We're gonna have to get real freaky deaky here in space. Dun, 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 dun,
dun, dun, dun, dun. It was a huge hit, just like all the others. What can I say? People love garbage.
He was winning again, and that's what she couldn't stand.
The IRS seizing the president's bank accounts, apartment, even his son, Don Jr.
For some reason, Dad had me listed as office furniture, so they put me in a box with chairs and stuff and drove me to storage.
And the worst part was that it was on President Stein's personal orders.
A despicable abuse of presidential power, can you imagine?
I mean, you can't do that. Is this America or what?
Of course, it was Trump himself who set the model of the authoritarian presidency we live under today.
Game recognized game.
And I don't blame him one bit for what he did next.
And then Donald Trump, the man none of us could avoid for 40 years, was gone.
So in the last 6 years, you haven't seen your father?
No. But my father's troubles haven't hurt my own personal brand.
And what is your brand?
Success and glamour. Now, excuse me, please. Would you like to try our new fragrance, Covfefe?
Yo, f*** you, traitor.
Screw you, pal!
Oh, I haven't seen him in years. But, you know, I've moved on now. I'm just Richard Pence from Key West.
You're Mike Pence from Indiana.
No, 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 no. Mike Pence was a Republican laughingstock who couldn't win a primary after 2020. Richard Pence was inspired by President Trump's leftward shift and is now running to represent the Florida Keys in Congress. I am much happier these days. Bobby, no, not now, but I'll see you back at the office. Much happier.
Just say, I am the victim. I feel like I'm being emotionally kidnapped. Okay, bye-bye. Boko Haram. I mean, such nice guys.
I haven't seen him. I'm finally at peace now. Sweeping the ashram, dusting the ashram, and updating the website for the ashram. And then on Wednesdays, I go into the woods and shoot shit. Just kidding. It's not loaded. Whoa, there was a couple in the chamber.
I don't know where he is, but I miss him like hell.
Mooch, you're up.
Just give me a second. 1 second.
There is a house down in New Orleans.
When did you last see Trump?
I haven't seen him in years, but I narrowed down his possible whereabouts. Bear with me. Yeah. Tell me I lost it again. Damn it, where'd I put it? Yeah! God. He's either been pulled across the river Styx to the Egyptian underworld of Duat, or he's in South Florida.
Is that Palm Beach? Isn't that where Mar-a-Lago is?
That resort has many names. The ancients called it Lar-a-Mago. Allow me to take you there. Come on. It's right up here. Here. McLeod. Donald McLeod. Name ring a bell?
His mother's maiden name.
Huh? Oh, yes. Exactly. And behold.
You're stealing my teeth. You're stealing my teeth.
I'm not stealing your teeth.
By the lodestone of Wotan!
No, no, no,
I have found you, sir!
No, no, no! What are you doing here? What are you doing here?
You're old attack dog! I was your XO! Your +5 broadsword!
No, get out of here! Get out of here! Steve, go!
Unbelievable. Here we are in Arizona, so beautiful, celebrating Sheriff Joe Arpaio. So great.
It appears that the presence of TV cameras really brings the president back to his old self. It's pretty unsurprising, actually. Someone should have thought of it earlier.
MS-13 is ruining all of
our... You said before you didn't know where the president was.
Well, yes. That was Richard Pence. Mike Pence has been coming back every other week to take care of him.
Eat it. Eat it.
Honestly, we did a pretty good job of hiding him. Of course, it helped that no one was looking.
Look at this guy, big tough guy. He covered the rally. People need to see me back on stage. America, you're about to get the best rally you've ever seen in your life.
You who are close to death, behold the man who will give you eternal life. The next and final president of the United States, Donald J. Trump! Come on!
Wow. Come on. Wow. So incredible. So incredible. Steve Batman, everyone. And Mike Pence right over here. Mike, there he is, folks. So great. So great. Oh, also, he hurts me. He chokes me with food, and he hits me when I'm sleeping.
No, that's not true. That's
yes,
not
it
true.
Is, Mike.
No.
Yes, it is. I'm running again because you all love me and you all hate each other. You do. You just need me to remind you. Look at that guy right there. What war did you serve in, buddy?
Vietnam.
You idiot. Only stupid people risk their lives for this country, Mr. Normal Foot. You couldn't figure out how to get out of it? It's the simplest thing. These people figured it out, but not you, loser. Diabetics, where are my diabetics at? Everyone thinks you're pigs. Because you couldn't control yourselves, you had to have the cake and the pie and the sauce. And look, there's Crooked Janet. She cheats at bingo.
I do not.
Yes, you do.
Yes,
you do. And the fake doctors, right? Always lie. Good cholesterol, bad cholesterol. It's the same thing, folks. The same thing. And they give you a bad, and they tell you that your butthole's gone. Where did it go? They've got your buttholes locked up in the office right over there.
By warring gangs of dolphins. And finally, a solemn day in New York City today at the funeral of former President Donald Trump. Almost no one was out on the streets save for the large number of white tarps present. None of the former living presidents in attendance, although they were eating lunch together five blocks away. A video President Trump had made before his death was shown at the service.
Hello, America. I did it. I made the future happen. People used to say fascism would never come to America, but then I came along and made it look easy because the Republican Party had laid the groundwork for over 70 years. I didn't take over the party. I just ripped the veil off. Turns out it was a hood. Knowing the American people, and I know them better than you think, believe me, you'll turn me into a monster of history. An inhuman anomaly that won't repeat. You think everything you hate about me will die when I do. Maybe you're right. Maybe you'll look in the mirror and confront the social and economic inequalities that have plagued America since its founding and start building a new world full of empathy, community, peace, and understanding. But boy, does that sound boring. Yuck. I was the president. Can you believe it? Bye-bye.
But we had one more important sound we wanted you to hear.
Go, 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 go